the annual report, which obviously we're concerned about. But the primary theme, so to speak, of today is where do we go from the last meeting based on the resolution we adopted. So if you see in your pack, and the Deputy Minister has to leave shortly, so he'll explain in a moment, but there's a one-pager, excuse me, there's a one-pager, sorry, two-pager, and you'll see the all parties agreed on 3A, right? Appropriation and representation of trade unions. B, consideration be given to amending the bill, the Act, sorry. 3, we think that the PIC should consider investing in projects at a developmental. 4, we should consider trade union proposals on a housing loan scheme. 5, that's E there. To raise our concerns with the Minister and Deputy Minister, that's what we're doing today. But he's been briefed by his DDG and by his Parliamentary Liaison Office, and I also spoke with him fleetingly in the House. And then we ask, please, Deputy Minister, that you meet with the public sector unions as soon as possible. Perhaps you want to tell us what's happened since we proposed that. Yes, we wanted to know why is it that there's still a persistence in a forensic investigation. Maybe there's a need, but we don't see the rationale. So if such a thing is going ahead, we're not saying, you see, there's a confusion in the media. If you look at this resolution, it doesn't say you mustn't have a forensic investigation. It says if you want to have one, you must actually set out the rationale and basis for it. And if it's correct that the attack on the CEO of PIC was just so false as it's presented in the media, and as was presented to us in the committee last time, then surely the people who are behind it must be ferreted out. And is there progress in that regard? The PIC board will respond to us. And then we note the trade unions are opposed to the Deputy Minister of Finance chairing the board, and they acknowledge, though, that the Minister and Deputy Minister have to have a relationship because after all, it's a defined benefit fund, and if things go wonky, then it's the right taxpayer and therefore the ministry that will have to come to the party, as it were, or the other way around. Now, the DA has come with a memorandum of their bill already. It's been tabled, and therefore we have to follow the processes. And since we're looking at a committee bill anyway, I've spoken to Mr. Mania again yesterday. He will speak to the bill. The memorandum is distributed to you. There are parliamentary rules. Ah, Frank Jenkins is not here. Somebody's substituting for him. Who's the gentleman? You're substituting. Sorry. You'll introduce yourself. You'll take us through the PIC Act, and then the processes by which we deal with the money bill, private members bill, and then you'll comment on questions raised of you. Then the last thing is to say that we'll meet in November, which is what we're doing. So that's basically it. Welcome, everybody. The Deputy Minister has indicated that he has urgent responsibilities, not least related to the Division of Revenue Bill. And I think that at an appropriate time, we can exit him, because we want him just to respond to the issues as a chairperson of the board. And we understand that he has to leave, I think, unless members have an objection. I think we should let him go. But let's hear what he has to say in the first instance. Welcome, Deputy Minister. I explained to them that you couldn't attend because you're in Washington. In fact, you even suggested to me that we postpone the meeting because you were very keen to come. So it is beyond your control that you couldn't come. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Chair. Honourable members, again, my apologies that I couldn't be here the last time, as the Chair said. It was completely because of the things which are outside my command. Obviously, there's GPF here, the chair, it's here, and its officer, and myself, and then CEO and other officials from PIC. Broadly speaking, obviously, we're here. There are questions which were raised to PIC in particular by the committee. We have responded to those questions, and we are here today. If there are any follow-ups that must be done, definitely we are happy to attend to them. But a principal statement that I would like to make, Chair, is that nothing has changed at PIC. PIC has got its policies which guide it deals with its investments. So nothing has changed since the appointment of the new finance minister and the new chair. There's not a single policy of PIC which has changed yet. That's one. Secondly, which start answering some of the questions which may come. The board of PIC has got 13 members, including the deputy minister. When the new minister was appointed, there were 5 board members whose term had ended. So the minister had an opportunity to appoint new board members or reappoint those board members. He decided on the latter to reappoint those board members without any change. That's very important to deal with some unfounded narratives, because if there were other ulterior motives except those which are to the best interest of PIC, I'm sure that's where the minister would have started. It also talks to the confidence that the minister has on the ability of the board and management of PIC to deal with the affairs of PIC. There are only 3 new board members at PIC, including the deputy minister, the deputy chair, and one board member. So out of 13, there are only 3 new board members. So why I'm mentioning that, Chair, it's important to say there is corporate governance at PIC. There's a way in which decisions are taken. There is no individual, he be a chairman or a deputy minister, who can steamroll any decisions to the members of the board. Secondly, from where we are seated, we are very much happy about the diversity of the skills that are there in the board of PIC, and we have got no reason to say any of the board members who are there is not capable of performing his fiduciary duties. I think that's important just to underline, Chair. One of the things that came up was the question of representativity of public sector trade unions. I think the minister said that from his side, obviously still speak for himself, that it makes all the sense for us. Those are the main beneficiaries of the fund. So it makes all the sense that they be represented, and it's something that the minister would be very happy to engage the trade unions on and look into it. The meeting with the public sector unions, Chair, it has not happened. When the minister came back from Washington D.C., you'll remember that it was a week before the MTPPS, so it was MTPPS all the way, and immediately after that he had to go on a roadshow. As a matter of fact, he's still outside the country, but it's one of his priorities to engage. Chair, you know that's natural for us. The most of those trade unions are our alliance partners, so the federation. They remain Mazambane. They remain. This our alliance partners, and it's an engagement that will definitely welcome. We think it, and it can only strengthen the PIC board, and we deal with all the issues that may be of concern from our side and from their side. But even further than that, talking about the unions, we are happy to engage any South African who wants to raise issues around PIC and the way that they want to hear if they've got some opinions. If those things can make us deal with our issues better, we're open-minded. You know, Chair, that that's the policy of the ANC. We engage with everybody. If we could speak with the Nationalist Party, then after all those things, who can we not talk to? So we're very much open-minded. What was the mistake? So there's no point we can differ, but if there's one thing that we don't shy away from, it's a question of engagement. We are really, really open-minded, and I'm saying that very, very seriously, that even with the members of the opposition, let's engage on these things, and and he and agree to differ, and I've got no doubt there are other areas where we'll agree. When I spoke to the deputy chair and the CEO, they spoke about the question that is being raised about the forensic audit, that the and other things that the minister had asked for. He had also asked for the publication of other investments, which have already happened and started last year when I was still the member of the committee. About these other issues, the PIC board decided to further engage with the minister so that they can try to get some of the clarifications and some of what he's trying to achieve with these things. So that meeting has not happened for the same reasons that I've given for the failure of the meeting between the minister and the public sector unions. Chair, to repeat what has been said before this committee, that the PIC is guided by GEPF mandate as to how, where they can invest. So that's how they deal with their investment. One of the issues which have been raised is the question of the involvement of PIC with the state-owned enterprises. We are responding in writing, but it's not a new thing. The PIC has been involved with the SOEs before, and when they do that, they would look at the mandate, GEPF mandate that guides us and its investment criteria. And if you pass, you pass. If you fail, you fail. I've never heard the board of PIC nor the management saying that they have been coerced and cajoled to do things that they are not supposed to do. As a matter of fact, we are involved with the DBSA, that is Development Bank of Southern Africa, and this year DBSA, I think because of PIC's involvement, amongst other things, they're able to make a 2.8 billion rand profit. I think PIC takes pride on that involvement. We are part of AXA. We are part of the land bank, and the land bank chair also reported profit of about 300 million rand, if I'm correct. So we do get involved, and I think there is a simple thing that let's also be involved in developmental economy. Let's also be involved in the transformation of our economy. We can't be bystanders as PIC and only celebrate that we are only investing on the JSE listed companies. Perhaps I must say that in our engagement in the board, talking about our involvement with all these other companies, one of the things that we are saying that we can't be mute on questions of transformation and employment equity in these companies. We are invested. We can't just be expected to be silent investors in these companies. So whether it's a JSE listed company or a private investment, the transformation of this economy, which this committee has been seized with, the transformation, especially of the financial services sector, that we can't be expected to be to be bystanders. As PIC will completely be involved and make the necessary, or let me put it that way, let's make our inputs to make sure that those companies do transform. They don't just benefit from the investment of the workers, but after that, it's about profits and nothing else. So we are looking at a broad way of saying, because you have got, we also deploy board members as PIC to those companies to say what exactly their role is when they go to those companies as far as this broad development and agenda of our country and transformation and employment equity are concerned. So, Chair, I just thought let me touch on those things because I know that the committee has been seized with those things. And if there are any other issues that one needs to clarify, we'll be happy to do that. But thank you very much. There is as I said, GPF is here, PIC is here. Happy to be guided some of these things by this committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you, DM. Over to members. Questions, please. Comments. Yes, Mr. Beria. Please.
Thank you, Chair. I think this is. I just want clarification about the minister's letter, which, as I understand, was dated the 9th of October 2017, to which you referred in your presentation. I just want to be clear. The letter, if I understand it correctly, traverses three matters. The first is disclosure of further information, which you mentioned. The second is it refers to the provision of further information requested at a board meeting, I think, on the 26th of September 2017. And then finally, it requests terms of reference to be furnished to the Minister's office in respect to forensic audits on the 23rd of October 2017. The Monday before the medium-term budget policy statement. So I just want to confirm that the PIC board's position is that you are seeking a meeting with the minister to discuss all the issues in the letter, and that up until now there's been no disclosure, no furnishing of further particulars in respect of the specific matters, and also no terms of reference furnished to the minister as requested by him. Is that correct?
Peace.
Thanks, Chair. When the minister introduced the board, he just mentioned that there are three board members, if I heard him correctly. The deputy minister, I don't know who else, and one member. If it's possible that he can give us the name of the board member and also his or her credentials, so that we are all clear that he is fit or she's fit to be serving in the board.
Thank you.
Next. Mr. Chairman, can I just clarify? I've got some kind of more technical questions about the responses. Is this the right time to ask those questions or not?
I think that should be.
Okay. No, that's fine. I'm happy with
that. You remember the committee made the point legitimately that the chair should be here of the board. Secondly, there were issues that, strictly speaking, the chair of a board should respond to. So it's in that regard. And unless members feel otherwise, I think it's fine to let the DM go. It's really Parliament now to take over. By the way, may I welcome the trade unions who are here. I think COSATU certainly, and I think FEDUSA is here. Yes, and we will give them some space to speak. Although today's meeting, as you know, is a meeting to carry over the decisions we took. Also, members have been given a copy of COSATU's proposed bill and the DA's proposed bill, and we're working with Frank Jenkins and the team on a committee bill taking into account those two bills. And welcome, by the way, to everybody else who's here. Also to report that Tandi is not available to come to the meeting. She's not well, so she won't be here today. Okay, can we move on, please? Who's next? Mr. Lees. Oh, you've done, right? Are you done? So, yes, our friend there from the EFF.
Thank you, Chair. No, I just need clarification on the conversations they are going to have with the unions pertaining the participation as board members and representatives of the workers, because on the written answers here, there is a law, Rule 413, that provides for only one pensioner representative. So when he says they are going to have conversations, is he also looking into changing this particular law, or what's going to happen? Because it only provides for one. And as far as we know, there's so many unions that are participating in the PSCPC, and then there's the two federations, the two major federations, and there's more.
All right, over to you, DM.
Thanks, Chair. I think the answer, Honourable Mayor, is of all these issues that you are raising in the letter, and all these issues that you are raising on the letter, the PIC board still wants to engage with the minister. So it's only after that that we'll be able to clarify on all of them. But as I said, that the private investment disclosures have already taken place, and we have already started doing it even before the minister's letter. about other things, the board would like to have further engagements with the minister about the credentials of the new board members. I'm sure Dr. Tolani Mkhwana last time did attend to his credentials, but obviously it's somebody who has served in many boards, still serving in many boards, has been a CEO of many companies, in including state-owned companies, and at some stage he was responsible for the increases that we're getting from Eskom as far as electricity is concerned when he was at the National Energy Regulator. But it's somebody who's got a good credentials, and from where we're seated, his understanding of corporate governance are beyond dispute. The other member is Ms. Matukana Mukoka. She's a CA. She's serving on many boards as it were. I know for a fact that she's a former chair of the audit committee of the Lotteries Board, now the commission, but she does still serve on other private companies. So I can assure the committee that the credentials of the board members, they are beyond dispute, and from my interaction with them in the board, their understanding of their role in the board is also very important. I think, Chair, that's one very important thing about being a board member, because the responsibility of you as a board member and the responsibility of management is very important. What I've seen before is where people start straddling on areas which is not their areas, where you find people that you go in as a board member and you end up being an executive director when you are a non-executive director. So that does create a problem. But what I'm then, Chair, but what I'm then saying that delineation of responsibilities and understanding of these responsibilities, it becomes very, very important. So, Chair, from my interaction with them, I think I'm very happy with the board in general, because these individuals become part of a team. As we talk about this thing, I usually hear people talking as if the chairman have got some particular powers. The chairman is just one of the directors. It doesn't have any special powers. It doesn't have any casting vote. He's just one of the many in that board. And I think it's the right way to have it that way, Chair, because you get persuaded and you persuade each other and dissuade each other. If you have got arguments, please put them on the table so that we can subject them to debate, and then the most elegant suggestion ends up the decision which is being taken. But I just wanted to say, when I look at the whole mix of the directors of PIC, both executive and non-executive, I'm happy. And again, I'm speaking for the board about the quality of the directors that we are having. About the conversation with the unions, I from the decisions that were taken by the committee was the question of the minister engaging with the unions. Without having seen exactly what they want to raise, I guess there are many issues that they would like to raise with the minister. So it's not about any one particular issue. I'm sure everything will be open for discussion. They may be having an opinion on a number of things. So more than anything else, I think the minister will be approaching that meeting open-mindedly and hear what the unions have to say. There's no particular one matter that we think that the minister will be looking at. But obviously, will be guided by the unions as they interact with the minister. I'm sure the minister will have his own issues that he'd also like to take up with the unions. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah. Is there anything else people want to raise? Yes, Mr. Menia.
Just on my further point, so it's correct to conclude that no terms of reference in respect of forensic audits were furnished to the minister by the 23rd of October 2017. A, is that correct? And I wonder if you could just expand on why the board took that view. I just want to be absolutely sure. No terms of reference have been furnished to the minister in respect of the forensic audits as per his request by the 23rd of October 2017. I just want to confirm that that is correct, and I wonder if you could just expand on why the board took that view.
I thought you answered the question. Well, that's fine. Okay.
Chairperson, I'll start by saying the board would like to have an interaction with the minister so that it clarifies on things that it's not very clear about, right? That's the main thing. Two, I think we take a view as a board that we should not run away from any discussion. We don't even want to assume that the relationship is adversarial. So it's a question that the minister has written to the board through me, and then the board has looked at the letter and say, well, there may be many interpretations of this letter. So the best way of dealing with this thing is to have an across-the-table conversation and then clarify issues. So there's no other reason.
Please.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to make a follow-up on what the DM has said so that I'm clear of what he has said. I have the same understanding. Following the question by Honourable Member Mende, that the minister said he is not aware, he cannot confirm the agenda. The unions might have many other issues that they want to raise, and the minister might have other issues. And if that's the correct understanding, I just want to question the treasurer, the ministry, that I believe that the discussion will be around the matter, that the PIC matter and the GEPF. And be aware that you don't open up to an extent that you take a responsibility of the PCPC, because that might compromise you as treasurer. It's not your mandate. So I'm just questioning that in those discussions, it must be clear as to what is it that they're going to discuss. And the two federations are here representing all the public sector unions as they appear in the meeting. Just to assist, sir.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, shall we round up then? Any more questions? Because we need to draw this part to a close. We've got quite a long agenda. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks, Honourable Member. I take the point. I think whatever comes out of that discussions will make sure that is within the prescripts of all the laws and statutes that are guiding us. But obviously, if there are issues which perhaps must come back to Parliament and so on, and I'm sure that it's an issue which will say, no, this doesn't belong to us. If that's the case, it belongs to Parliament.
Please, the last question, that is.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be brief. I'm satisfied on the whole question of the letter. There's a separate matter. I mean, the committee, I took the view, and I think the committee supported me, although I stand corrected. It was a view in the committee that given the sort of use of fake email and the whole sort of, if you like, political hit on the chief executive officer that took place earlier this year. The question was is the PIC investigating, or has the PIC launched an investigation to determine who was behind that matter?
There, it's true Mr. Mania raised it, but it's a committee decision. It's about fair play. But we should also point out, as I did say, precisely because you say it smokes and mirrors, it's got nothing to do with the CEO. We as a committee cannot know whether a person is guilty or whether they've been found not guilty, if you know what I mean. You never know. You know, we've been through this before in the parliamentary committees where we think somebody is here was Walter Sisulu, and we exonerate the person. nothing to do with you. And then 3 weeks later, or 3 years later, or 4 years, and I've been through it, by the way, with one state-owned entity. Later it emerged that senior official was, well, he finally had to resign and so on. So what we are very careful to say, you will recall at some stage when I said, from what we can see, there's nothing that the CEO has done that's irregular. From what we can see, there's no need for an inquiry. From what we can see. So we are very careful in our choice of words. But, you know, the media being the media, they will leave out the from what we can see. So from what we can see, the CEO is innocent of the allegations against him. From what we can see, it is just wrong to damage a person's reputation. I said that about Mr. Mkonazi. DM, you are not here. I said it is outrageous that people refer to him as a Guptaite. There's no evidence of it. No evidence. And given that Guptaism has become a swear word, and in my view, rightly so, and I can be quoted anywhere on that, it's wrong to do that, DM. I made it clear. It's people's integrity that gets damaged. Similarly, the CEO will never escape if he's 100% innocent. You know, generations from now, people who do theses and so on, they're going to look at that issue, and you won't be there to answer for yourself, CEO. So we are very clear. Since there is no evidence before us, we feel that that inquiry should be pursued. I mean, fairness. It is wrong for people to accuse others when there's no evidence. So I think what Mr. Mania is saying is exactly correct. As a committee, as a whole, we feel that should be done. I was going to pick that up because I'm going through it now quickly and seeing what I should say at the end of this session, of this part of the meeting. Thank you, dear.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Member. I must say that in my life, generally, I think I've been guided by fairness. And it's something that I've lived for. And I'll be the last person to see somebody being unfairly accused of something. Moreover, because I've been there before, I know how it feels to be accused of things that you don't know. So I must just give the committee that assurance. That's the basis of our strike was justice. So to do things unjustly and accuse people and so on without evidence, it's something that I wouldn't be associated with. And listening to the board that I chair, I also get that same impression. A little bit of a correction, I think, from Honourable Mainir. We don't know who James Nogu is. That's the person who wrote this thing. So it will be presumptuous to say it was a political hit on the CEO. I think the CEO will share with the committee as how far they've gone with that process, because it's within his remit. He's dealing with that. But from my side, and speaking for the Minister of Finance, there was never a political hit directed on anyone, let alone the CEO of PIC. And the CEO of PIC himself is on record in public having said that there was no political hit aimed at him. And if I may, Chair, I think the relationship that I have with the executive, not unless they say they argue differently, it's a very professional relationship that we keep, and the relationship that I've kept wherever I find myself deployed before. So we don't know James Nogu whether he's a politician or a big capitalist. We have got his own issues.
Can I just raise a few quick things? We don't need to preoccupy ourselves. Just some things. Sorry, yeah.
But I appreciate that. So are you saying that the CEO will brief us on where we are on that matter? I'm happy with that.
Okay. Just on that matter, it does strike me, DM, it's a bit odd for the CEO to be in charge of an investigation looking into who it is that is supposed to have smeared him. Very odd. It's very odd. I don't know if other members pick it up, but it does strike me as very odd. In theory, I'm not saying Dan will do that. In theory, he could identify somebody he doesn't like. Okay, in theory, I'm saying. And by the way, Dan, this is where we've come to. And we are all complicit here, including the media. This is our country. We can't run away from our respective responsibilities. And the media has played a role in besmirching people. If you listen to the media, Mr. Mkhonazi is like literally going to Mr. Gupta's house every morning and getting a mandate, right? Yet there's no evidence of it. Again, from what we can see, he's totally innocent of those allegations. And there's nothing wrong with having relations with any families, but given the politicization of where things are. So the first thing is, yeah, I don't think we should preoccupy ourselves. It does look very odd that the CEO is managing it. It should be a board member who's non-executive, it seems to us. DM, you've served on various boards. You know industry and you know corporate rules. Can you look into that? Secondly, can we plead with you to... We understand the pressures you and the minister are under, and we're very sympathetic. It's your first MTBPS in the most challenging climate, right? And we're very sympathetic and empathetic, and you can see we worded our resolution softly. But now we are where we are, and the year is coming to an end. So can we plead, Comrade DM, that you meet with the trade unions very soon? In any case, a bill is about looming over us, and we also need your responses to it. Then on the issue of the unions, I think they'll be here. We'll speak to them later. Oh, Mr. Maine has covered me on what you're doing about the inquiry into allegations against them, this thing. The other thing that comes up, DM, I got this from the media as well. On the unlisted investments, there are people who ask me, Chairperson, what are you doing about these unlisted investments? And they cite examples of investments by the PIC in unlisted companies that have borne no fruit and will bring no reward, economic or other, financial, to the members of the pension funds. Now, those are very detailed ones. Obviously, these journalists also have their own political agenda. I know where it comes from, but hey, they have a right to ask. I then said, no, I can't speak now because this matter has not been discussed by the committee and I'm not sufficiently conversant with that. We have looked at the unlisted investments last year or the year before. At that stage, the majority in the committee, apart from one member, two members, felt that they are investing in the sort of thing you said, DM, in developmental projects. Yes, they're unlisted companies, but precisely because of transformation, et cetera, et cetera. Do you want to comment on that or maybe leave it to the CEO? What is being done about investments in unlisted companies where the rewards are few, either in developmental terms or in returns for the members of the pension fund? Thank you.
Chair, on the first matter, if I were to explain, I was just saying that the CEO will report on it, but it is a matter which the ethics committee of PIC assist with the investigations. But I think he'll definitely report on as where they are. But even saying that the committee, it becomes different for non-executive members, because one of the things which was one of the assumptions is that there was a hacking of the IT because of the company. So you still need the involvement of management there. It's a question of getting that balance, but it is a member of the ethics committee of subcommittee of the board. I take the point, Chair. We'll work on this meeting between the trade unions with the minister. I've had an interaction with the performance or non-performance of some of the unlisted investments. Although I think it's half the story, because one may want to argue that there have been listed investments which have not performed. Yeah. So I think when we approach that, we'll have to approach with that broad understanding that business, one of the things which is at the center of running a business, that you are taking a risk. And usually when you measure these things, you want to do it on the balance of your whole portfolio as to what has happened. There will be investment here and there. I'm not talking to any of the particular investments which have been raised even in the media, but I'm just saying that would be my approach. I had an interaction with the CEO, raised the very same matter, and I said it's out there. I would like the board to discuss that so that executives should know what is happening. So the management general will be reporting to the board about those investments, what has happened, and so on. So that would be my take, Chair.
Okay, in that case, DM, I'm sure it's okay for you to be excused and your officials here will brief you on outstanding matters. Having said that, can we move on then to the next item?
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you again. GEPF and PIC. Before we do, can I just alert members and also everybody else who's here? The committee needs about 10 minutes to look at the program for the rest of this year because we've got onerous deadlines and we have to meet in the afternoons and so on. And as a start, and it's already been seen hopefully, the chairperson himself will not blabber, no anecdotes for the next 2 weeks, except for the order side, no even jibe at Mr. Mania. You'd have seen today there hasn't been a single one. It's business unusual. No one believes me, but it's going to happen. Right, good. GEPF, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
CEO Abel Stole is here. He couldn't be here because of other duties the last time. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
I said just about 20 minutes.
Yes.
Sure. What they've explained very quickly, colleagues, and we agreed, they're going to deal with the annual report and weave in the answers to the questions that you've asked, and others have been given to you in writing. So you don't have to belabor the answers because they have it in writing. Thank you.
Right. So, and I'm going to hand over now to
Thanks, Chair. Just to the team, Dr. Mukate again, our chairperson, Major General Dries de Wert, our deputy chairperson, Mr. Seth McCartney, who is the chair of the Finance Committee today. We're talking about the annual report, and he's the main person responsible for that. Ms. Linda Mateza, who kindly stood in for me when I was here last time, and she's here. Adi Fanike, the company secretary, and our finance manager, Mr. Musama Besa, and our communications, Ms. Mata Omulapo. Chair, there are probably about three or four slides that are very, very important, and I'm going to go very quickly through the other slides, purely because I do need to highlight where some of the questions that have been provided in writing are covered in our presentation and to clarify by and large. The first important slide is the slide that speaks about the governance of the GPF, and there's one line that I always want to emphasize, and that's the last bullet point in that slide, to remind people that the GPF is a juristic entity. Now, that might sound like kind of a passing statement to make, but it's very, very important because you need to understand that the GPF is an entity which owns its assets and liabilities. The assets of the GPF do not belong to anybody, but actually belong to the GPF, as are the liabilities in terms of the benefits that have been promised to members and pensioners. When we talk about the size of the GPF, the 1.67 trillion, we also need to remember, it sounds like a really huge number until you have to divide it by the total number of people to whom it belongs, not to any other thing. So 1.6 trillion is a lot of money. Divided by 1.273784 active members and 423130 pensioners and beneficiaries, suddenly you get a perspective. I do this pretty much every morning to get myself grounded, because when you think about 1.66 trillion, you get big-headed, and then when you realize how many people actually it's supposed to be looking after, you become sized properly. So when you think of the GPF, it's not the 1.6 trillion, it's the money that belongs to people. But more important, it owns the assets and the liabilities. The money does not belong to government. It belongs to the GPF. This is just GP law. The point that I just want to emphasize, which is the question that was asked, speaks to question one, which has to do with representation. Now, the GPF is governed by a board which represents both the employer and the employees, pensioners as well. There was an honorable member who indicated that how the board is appointed is quite important, because there's a lot of this that is not said in the statement or when you look at the slides in passing, is the fact that the employer appoints board members who represent major stakeholders. And the major stakeholders will be, in most instances, the big departments, education, health, the police, and then, of course, there's a special dispensation for the forces. And then, of course, on the other side, you have members who are represented via their unions, and that's where the PSCBC becomes a major player in what the GPF does. Nothing that the GPF can do to the fundamental operation of the GPF unless it speaks to representatives of members via labor, and more specifically via the PSCBC. So the board is robust, comprising of both employer representatives and employees. If there's going to be any kind of capture, it's going to be at a grand scale, because you have to ensure that all the eight employer-appointed representatives, who include two independents, can prevail over all the other other members of the board who represent members. And actually, those are senior people in the labors that they come from. So if you actually look at the annual report, you'll see that the people that are deployed by labor are not just the ordinary members of the labor union. They actually deploy senior people who are able to engage with the issues of the GEPF. So governance is very, very robust. The other slide that's very, very important, of course, is the one that speaks to the governance structure of the GEPF. The board is the ultimate authority in making the decisions of how the board manages the fund and nobody else. And they do this via committees. The chair of those committees, two of them are here. The one is the vice chairperson of the board, who is also the chair of the Benefits and Administration Committee. Now, this is very, very important. These are the benefits that members actually look forward to. The money is very, very important, but to members, it is what benefits are we getting. And very little is said about the benefits that members actually enjoy. And there's been a lot of work that's been done to, number one, safeguard the benefits as they currently are, but over many years to improve them and to try and make sure that members get the benefits. But you hardly hear anything said about that. And, of course, today we're speaking about the annual report, and we have the chair of the Finance and Audit Committee as well. There is the chair of the Governance and Legal Committees who was here last time, Ms. Barbara Watson. She was with the delegation from the GEPF at the last conversation with the committee. And then we have the Investment Committee, which is chaired by the chair of the board with me again today. And then we also have the chair of the Remuneration Committee, who is an independent specialist with many years of experience and actually with colleagues who are also highly experienced. You also have another important committee which speaks to the investments, the valuations subcommittee of the board. This looks at issues of impairment, where we investing in assets that are not listed. They are valued independently by external people via the PIC, and the PIC will probably speak to that as well. But there is a specific committee in the GEPF that actually looks at those valuations and is the one that finally has to give their okay to those actually being put onto the annual financial statement of the board. Now, the most interesting thing, and if I have time to speak to show it, is that we always speak about impairment in the negative, and it's always important to understand that impaired assets are not all of them necessarily going to be written off. Actually, there are recoveries. There are companies that are managed sometimes with the engagement of the asset manager, the PIC, where resources are deployed, whether it's directly from the PI itself or specialists being put in those entities to actually turn them around. And we do have examples of companies that were impaired that have been turned around. So again, a very, very important committee of the board. And then, of course, the Social and Ethics Committee are very important in terms of making sure that what we do at the GEPF, and of course giving guidance both to the PIC, which also has its own committees, and the government's pensions administration agency, the PAA, to give guidance from a board perspective. The next point that I want to talk about was a whole number of questions around who provides services to the GEPF. And again, the GEPF as a fund uses a number of statutory bodies that assist in the board in making decisions of how they go about executing their responsibilities. The external auditors are provided for in GP law. The valuator is provided for in GP law. And there's a whole range of specialist services that the board actually gets as and when they require assistance. Those talk to getting legal advice in some instances, or to when there's issues about specific questions that they want to actually address, whether it's with risk or they want advice on dealing with unlisted environment. They will go out and actually seek specialists to advise them, independent of the advice that they might be getting from the PIC. As we've done in the past, we always say that the GEPF is a triumvirate. You have the GEPF, which is the statutory entity that owns the assets and liabilities and promises benefits and has to ensure the assets are there. It then actually outsources mandates to the PIC to manage the assets, who then does the asset management themselves or does through other people. And then you have the GPAA, the Government's Pensions Administration Agency, which also does that. Now, it's important to understand that when the GEPF gives a mandate to the PIC or gives a mandate to the GPAA, it does not actually absolve itself of the responsibility, and it remains the one that owns it. So the PIC is an entity which manages on behalf of the GPF. There's a misunderstanding, and there was a question around how does the GPF view the relationship between the minister and the PIC. The government is 100% shareholder of the PIC, the corporate entity, not the assets that are being managed by the PIC. The assets that are managed by the PIC belong to the entities that have given the mandate to the PIC. So, yes, the minister is 100% shareholder. He can give whatever instructions that the minister wants to give to the PIC, the corporate entity, but he cannot actually tell the PIC how to manage the underlying assets, because those do not belong to the PIC. They belong to the owners, in this case the GPF, via an administration, a mandate in the terms of the PIC, or an administration agreement and a service level agreement in terms of the GPAA. So it's very important to separate the corporate entities vis-a-vis what they do as agents of the principals, the principal not being the government in that sense, but the principal being the owner of the asset, being the GPF. That, I think, is probably one of the most important slides, because I think there's a misunderstanding in terms of how the relationship between the GPF and the PIC, and the PIC and the minister is. The government owns the corporate entity, not the assets under the management. That is owned by the entity that actually are providing those monies to the PIC. I'm going to run through this because you've seen this in the annual report. This one speaks purely to how the investment has performed over a number of years. And I think what I want to highlight here is that one of the biggest challenges for the GPF, yes, there's an issue around the unlisted entity, the unlisted assets, which I will come back to, but the biggest challenge is the fact that I think the economy has not been performing very well, so the assets have not been performing as well. So from a GPF perspective, the biggest concern is more about how the economy overall is performing, and I will explain why that is key. And again, that speaks to the returns that have not been that significant. We have had returns in the double digits, but in the last couple of years, that has gone down. And again, so far, has not been a major issue, but if that continues, it starts speaking to the solvency of the fund, to the extent to which the assets and the liabilities are equal, or the assets are more than the liabilities. It's a much more fundamental issue. And again, that's driven by and large, yes, by how we invest and where we invest, by broadly how the economy is performing, given our overexposure to the South African economy. The contributions continue to increase, but at a rate that is slightly less than what we're actually paying out in benefits. And again, this is a major issue for the GPF. If we could reduce the benefit payments by about 20 billion, we will actually be releasing about 20 billion out there for investment. So making sure that we control resignations or try to minimize the amount of resignation is probably much more significant to the GPF than some of the concerns that I think might be in the public domain, because there is more value in making sure that members secure their benefits in the first instance, and of course, if they do that, the monies are available for investment in the future. There was a question about the level of funding of the GPF. I think what this shows you is that for many years now, the GPF has been more than 100% funded. We can talk about the issues around reserves and the extent to which they impact the fundedness. And there was a question about, so what are reserves? But those are not defined by the board. Those are actually defined by the actuary, one of the specialists that actually is appointed in terms of law. And the actuary would then say what reserves needs to be held to ensure that the funds remain sound, but also to ensure that you're not holding assets that are more than what you require, because the more assets you hold in reserves actually impacts on how much money is actually available out in terms of investments. So there's also a trade-off to not have too many reserves to determine your funding level, because that will actually constrain how you invest in overall. But the good news is that up to now, as of the 31st of March 2016, and we're now going to the next valuation on the 31st of March 2018, the fund is remains fully funded. And what I've done there is to indicate some of the questions that are dealt with, 8, 9, and 11 are covered there. Then, of course, the issues about pensioner increases. Again, I know that some pensioners will always argue that the CPI is not a true reflection of their own cost of living increases, and we appreciate that, but we can only use an officially determined metric, and that's the CPI as it currently stands. So there's always an argument with pensioners whether what we're reflecting is true to what they are experiencing. But the good news that we've been able to give pension increases over 100%, and so far that has been the trend that has continued over many years. And we're hoping that despite the difficult economic circumstances that we continue to be able to do so. And that's part of the reason why reserves are kept by the fund. In terms of investments, as I've indicated, the GPF manages the bulk of the PIC manages the bulk of the GPF's assets, and as the media has always asked me, are we happy with that and will we continue? The answer is that right now the PIC has performed in terms of the mandate given to them. We have had no reason to doubt their capability to manage the assets going forward, and we're quite happy with them to continue to do so. But of course, the question then becomes, but does the law say you are bound to the PIC? No, there's no law that binds us to the PIC, but at the same time, there's nothing that says we are not well served by actually having the PIC as our manager at this point in time, and we will see that relationship continuing into the future. The PIC is appointed like any other asset manager or like any other agent who serves the principal. There is a mandate given to them, and they manage the assets in terms of those mandates. They don't manage them in terms of instruction from external parties. And some of the guiding principles, and these are all in the annual report, it's not a secret as people like to make it, is that we have a strategic asset allocation. At the last SCOF, my colleague Linda presented to you with the asset liability modeling process of how we arrive at the strategic asset allocation. Again, it is not something that the trustees, who are board members, suck out of their thumb. They actually get professionals to help them with understanding what the liabilities of the GPF are. They are the benefits that we pay to members as and when they exit the fund. They are the benefits we pay to pensioners. But those are actually quite long term. I like to remind people that the youngest beneficiary is a toddler who will get a benefit until hopefully they are 22. If the changes that will come in front of you soon approve, if that toddler is disabled, they will be paid for life. We visit pensioners, and I come across pensioners who have been in pension for longer than they've been in service. I've come across a pensioner who's been in pension for 40 years. Only after having worked for less than that. So the time frame that we're working with is quite long, and we need a specialist to be able to put value in that and give us a sense of how do we actually ensure that we're managing the assets to be able to meet those liabilities. There's a question that's always been asked about...
17.
There's been questions asked about what other managers look after the assets of the GPF. No, this one talks to the bills and the bonds, the investments of the GPF in state-owned enterprises. And again, this is not a secret. It's always been something that we actually are more than happy to share. And as the last annual financial report, the bills that we invest in predominantly were still rated at investment grade. Now, there's a distinction between what the rating agencies do in terms of our foreign denominated bonds vis-a-vis our domestic bonds. And most of the downgrading happened in the foreign bonds, not in the domestic. And of course, some of these investments actually have government guarantees in them, which actually gives a much better rating from our perspective. That was in cases where there is a government guarantee. Just to make a statement in passing, I know people will read this to mean that some institutions are too big to fail. No, it's not the case, but we must remember most of these are quite key to the infrastructure of the country, and they are quite key to the rest of the investments of the GPF. So our investment in energy is quite key to our investment in mining and retail and any other investment that you want. Our investment in Sunrail, it's not about ETOLS. I mean, ETOLS is not even 1% of the total Sunrail. It's the national road system in the country. If that is not maintained and it's not running properly, it means the logistics that move our goods, our services, will be impacted. The Trans-Caledon Tunnel Authority is responsible for the main bulk water infrastructure. If that is not there, again, it will impact on everybody else. Doesn't mean that you must give them a free pass, but you must understand the size and the impact that they have on both the the economy of the country and the investments of the GPS in totality when you think about it. This one, Chair, speaks to one item that I want to highlight. There's been a lot of focus on unlisted, and it's amazing how small it is. The GPF is not in the business of writing checks to people to just squander the money. We invest to get the return, and of course, if you can do good in that process, so much the better. We do need to diversify in terms of the strategic asset allocation. Now, what I want to highlight is that if you look at that slide, you will see that unlisted loans or direct loans amount to 40 billion, and you must add that to another number, which is the unlisted equities, which amount to 46. In Afrikaans, the strang and drang that we've had in the country about the unlisted that the GPF is making actually amounts to nothing more than about 86 billion. I'm not saying we must not pay attention to it, but sometimes we pay attention to that and lose sight of the 1.5 trillion because we're so focused on this 80 billion. We need to focus on it, but we need to focus it in the totality of the GPF as a fund. We must not be giving members the impression that the whole total is somehow subject to some discretion by anybody. The majority of the GPF assets are listed in the market, which is not subject to the funnies that people suspect is happening elsewhere. Most of the assets that we invest are invested in the open market, even if it's state-owned enterprises. I think there's only been one tranche which was actually specially placed. Everything else is bought in the open market. The GPF and the PIC are not the funder of government or CSOE of last resort when you look at that statement. So a lot of what we talk about when you talk about the unlisted is 86 billion. Of course, that has been increased by an additional allocation, number one, to diversify from the listed space, but also to look for, as Dr. Denner will say, areas where we can actually meaningfully impact how the economy is behaving. The PIC does give mandates to other managers, and we give the names. That's in the annual report. In their report to the SCOF, to the committee, they've also provided details of the amounts that are given. They might not have identified which manager gets how much, but they've given you a better sense of the amounts that have been allocated to other managers outside of the GPF. Just to speak about it, we've reallocated an additional 70 billion in 2016, and not much of that has been invested. And the reason is that a lot of care goes to making sure that that money is invested. So although the PIC was given the mandate to go ahead, they haven't just went around and thrown the money around. They've applied their minds, or they are applying their minds, and continue to ensure that it is invested properly. The areas, I think, are there. It is very clear when you go to the report that the PIC has listed in terms of what the actual specific entities that have been listed in. But I think that the main focus, energy infrastructure, social infrastructure, economic infrastructure, priority sectors, SMEs, the environmental infrastructure, all those are the key areas that I think the House will probably be saying to the GPF you should be looking at, and we are, but not in a responsible manner. Just to start closing is that you have the law that dictates what are the benefits that members must enjoy. There's the law that says how the governance structures of the GPF must be managed. There are governance processes that are there in terms of the boards itself and the committees that actually assist the board to do what it wants to do. But there's also management that actually ensures that there's a total engagement. The level of engagement between the GPF and the PIC, I've worked in the private sector in both capacities as a pension manager and as an asset manager. The level of engagement between the GPF and the PIC is just so much tighter and so much clearer, simply because of the amounts involved and the number of beneficiaries. So the board meets every quarter. Before that, the committees meet, and of course on a monthly and sometimes on a weekly, and when there's always engagement between the GPF's management and the PIC to ensure that the investments are made in a manner that actually helps us to meet our objectives. Just to highlight the area that we hardly ever speak about are the benefits, which are quite important. There's always been benefits that have been improved over the years, and recently we agreed through the PSCBC with Labour and the employers to improve some benefits. Some of them have already come into effect. The funeral benefit has been doubled from 7,000 to 15,000 for members, their spouses and their partners, and children from 3,000 to 6,000. You don't hear much spoken about that. That actually came in effect on the 1st of October, together with some technical changes, one, making sure that members who are discharged get the same benefit as members who resign, and ensuring that we protect the fund and the members when they leave the fund, to ensure that when they leave the fund and the fund is underfunded, which is not the case, but that they still live with 100% of their benefit under the GEPF. But in circumstances where you have bulk transfers, which has not happened, like, for instance, the department was to start their own fund and the fund were underfunded, you want to make sure that the remaining members are not affected badly by that kind of a decision. There's been a number of other changes which are still coming to this House to finalize the law. So the board has agreed, the PSCBC has agreed, but to change the law ultimately is a parliamentary process. So that is on its way to this House and to Parliament. Is the change of the orphan's pension to a child's pension. Basically, currently, you need to have a situation where both parents are dead before you get a pension from the GPF if you're a child. That now becomes an issue of having just one parent die, and you become entitled to a benefit. More important is that the benefit is being increased from 10% to 25% for the first four children, and then proportionally adjusted depending on whether there's a spouse or more children, and it gets more technical. But it's one of the most significant changes that I think we've seen in the GPF. Probably the last one was the improvement in the resignation benefit. Then there's changes that are very close to members' heart. The change in the clean break principle from the notional debt service, which confused everybody, to an adjustment of service. Now that's going to be a big relief for members who have always been unhappy with misunderstanding how this was working. But that has been done away with. Those are coming to the House. Once the House has approved and the law has changed, the members will enjoy those benefits. And of course, pension increases I've spoken to. This speaks to detail about the administration. The last point that I want to touch on is the unclaimed benefits. This is one that I think, again, raises a lot of interest from members. There's been an increase from last year. Number one, the amount is 653 million it was last year, is 722. But I want you to focus on two items, the transfer from benefits and the benefits paid. So the amount is increasing, but a lot of that is actually falling within the last 2-3 years, which means we stand a very good chance of actually paying out the amounts. The fact that it's growing is in itself shouldn't alarm members, because the more important thing is that we actually are paying a lot of these unclaimed benefits that are occurring. Some of the old ones are much more difficult, and that's where the challenge is in terms of finding tracing. The good news is that we're piloting a situation where we actually go to the public and actually put the names of the people who might be entitled out into the public, and then of course there's still a lot of verification that needs to happen before somebody can actually claim. That will cut out the cost of having to employ tracing agencies and all those things, because the public will be able to say, I know Abel Sithole, I know he was working for the government, and then Abel Sithole will then have to come to us and say, yes, I'm Abel Sithole, here's my ID, this is where I work, this is the time that I work, and if all this ties up, we should be able to pay without having to actually go through a process of paying everybody else. What I did there was an age analysis, which is simply to make a statement that most of the amount that is unclaimed falls within the last 2-3 years. So the biggest amount is about 53% is in the last. The biggest percentage is only in the last year, and then the following year and the following year, which means those we are likely to pay. Chair. That is the last slide.
Guidance from members. Our main reason for being here is the resolution and the implementation thereof. So the primary consideration is on where we take this forward, bill-wise. We're running out of time. It's 11:20 now. We have to finish at 10 to 1. So we look at the program for the rest of this quarter. The question I want to ask you is, would it be agreeable to members if we take both the PIC submission and the GEP submission together? Okay, fine. In which case, Dan, unlike your colleague, can you try to stick within 20 minutes, please?
he took an extra 8.5 minutes. It's not fair, really. But he's showing off because the GEPF has got such good results, and I understand. That's good. Can we move on?
Yeah, but Chairman, we presented last time.
Yeah. There are outstanding questions, right, that you had to respond to. Yeah, that was the one.
I think the very first one is about the investigation.
Basically, it's not, if you've given us a written text, there's no need to go through the whole thing.
Yeah,
just highlight the key issues.
Yeah.
So any questions flowing from the last meeting that haven't been answered, A, and B, questions raised earlier with the DM that were deferred to you.
The investigation is conducted by an independent firm on behalf of the board and managed by the management, myself as the CEO. They have already reported to the Social and Ethics Committee as well as the Audit and Risk Committee. This coming Friday, they are going to report to the full board on their findings.
Is that the only outstanding question that you had to deal with?
The other one was touched on unlisted investment performance, and I think the committee needs to look at this from a portfolio context. If you look at the numbers that the GPF has shown on the growth of unlisted investment, it's almost 12.5% growth, showing that there is performance. But of course, a portfolio is a portfolio. You don't put all your eggs, as I say, in one basket. You diversify the portfolio. Some investments will do well, some will do badly, and for various reasons. And the most important thing is that we've got a team that looks after unlisted investment to see if there are ways of ensuring that they also perform in the long term. And we've been successful in a number of them through this intervention.
Technical question for the committee members to apply their mind to. What percentage of your investments are in unlisted investments? You know,
Chair, it's I call it the 97. Currently, it's 97.3%. It's 90. I like to say 97.3. So the 97% of the GPS assets are listed in the market, in the open market. It's only 3% that's actually sitting in the
market. Thank you very much. So that's done. Are we done? Okay, over to members' questions to both GPF and PIC. Mr. Lee, Mr. Mania, please. Derek, who else? Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you to Mr. Sitale and for all their responses. I do find them very informative, so thank you very much. You're at pains correctly to point out the fact that the assets belong to the GEPF, and no one should dispute that. I certainly wouldn't dispute that. However, the question I would like to put to you is, because it's a defined benefit fund which is guaranteed by the state, at what point does the state have some intervention in terms of the performance of the fund? I mean, if I was the guarantee and I would monitor very carefully that they're never going to call my guarantee in. And so surely there must be some kind of influence there. I think you make an incredibly important point about trying to encourage members not to withdraw their investments there. So I know that this is a fraught subject, but does the GEPF get involved in a kind of campaign to try and point out to members how important it is to maintain, and would the GEPF support legislation for preservation of retirement funding? Chairman, that I think is the GEPF. Just in terms of the question answer replies. Thank you very much for the response about the approach from SAA, and clearly the approach was unsuccessful. What were the reasons? I mean, SAA has been well known to be in trouble, and so one would probably think, well, I mean, no one's going to invest in something running at a huge loss like that. But has the situation changed? In other words, what were the reasons for not agreeing to make funding available? And has the situation now changed? Are we, if the approach was now made, given the changes that have taken place, would it be looked at more favorably or possibly not? Then in terms of the discussions with the government, the National Treasury, about the telecom shares, is there any kind of limits that you've already determined as to how far you'll go with taking on telecom shares? I seem to remember you saying something to us about that before, so forgive me if you have. But in other words, how far are you prepared to invest in telecom at this stage? Mr. Chairman, I fully understand the relative size of the unlisted investments and appreciate that the risk for the whole fund obviously is not as great as perhaps is made out from time to time. But nevertheless, I am concerned about the status of the independent news table on page 16 or slide 16. I'm not sure if I really understand the changes from the principal amount to the outstanding balance. The equity is dropped by some 70 million from 167 million to 95 million. So is that a sale of equity or is it simply a valuation issue? And then similarly on the loans, the loan balances have really jumped markedly. So from 183 million to 279 million, from 254 million to 461 million. Have we lent more money to them, or is it just very good interest returns? I would love to invest at that rate, if that's the rate. And then in the preference shares, they've increased markedly as well. So, Mr. Chairman, those are my questions. Thank you.
Dick Lady, can you just chair for a few minutes, when I will excuse myself for 5 minutes, please?
So a question to the GEP and the PIC. The Government Employees Pension Fund has, what, a 325 billion rand exposure to South African government bonds, a 37 billion rand exposure to corporate bonds, and 164 billion rand exposure to parastatal bonds. What is your outlook, and what steps would you take to mitigate the risk of a sovereign ratings downgrade or a further sovereign ratings downgrade, which could happen as early as the 24th of November 2017? I see then also on a separate matter that you have an 84 billion rand exposure to Eskom, which if you read recent report in the media seems to be about to experience a balance sheet blowout. Again, what is your strategy? Are you concerned, and what is your strategy to mitigate the risk?
I think it's Honorable Mali.
Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Liz, can you switch off your mic?
Unclaimed pensions, are you investing that money or are you just keeping it in your bank account? And if you're investing it when it appreciates value, do you pay with interest? I've seen it's a big amount of money. And how do you then make sure that employees who are based in deep rural areas are informed, because the last time we've had this presentation in public administration, we had complaints about people who are, I mean, employees in rural areas who are not necessarily being informed and who don't know where to go when they resign. And for the year 2016-2017, is it possible that maybe you can give us per province how many complaints were lodged on the delay of pension payout, and how do you deal with such complaints, and then whether do you give employees advice prior to them resigning, and your relationship with the human resource units within the government department, are they assisting in terms of making sure that the facilitation of pensions are paid on time? Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Mari. Before I give Honorable Hanekom, I think you will remember what the question asked here by Honorable Mari. I don't know if it's 2016 or 2015. We had a discussion about you making roadshows, keeping in touch with those rural people who are, I think it's a follow-up question. We have been asking that question. So it's just an emphasis. Honorable Aneko.
Thank you, Chairperson. I guess I'll approach my question in a slightly roundabout way, but PIC obviously has to serve its clients, and the GEPF obviously has to serve its members. And we've said it before that we felt as a committee that it's all about the members and their members' pension funds, and that a very good job has been done, and the history shows it. And I think that that's your core mandate. But we also appreciate the developmental component of your mandate. Clearly, I mean, the members are represented by trade unions who are here, some of whom are here. And the developmental mandate includes then investment in entities such as Transnet, Eskom, SANRAL, Land Bank, etc. Accepted. However, when things happening at these entities starts bringing, I mean, they're activities are intended to be developmental, they're essential activities, nobody questions that. But when the things that they do as state-owned companies become virtually counter-developmental, become highly questionable, is it possible for you to use your leverage as investors in these entities? I mean, for example, if Transnet spends more than 5 billion rand on a commission in the purchase of locomotives, that's workers' money. It's our state-owned company, and your workers' money is invested in that state-owned company. Do you put pressure on Eskom and Transnet to start doing the right things with the people's money? Thanks.
Thank you. Honorable Chibambo, are you stretching or are you raising your hand?
No, thanks, Chairperson. I think that must maybe deal with context issues, that the first time when we called the PIC and GPF, it was out of the concern that we had around what was National Treasury's interventions or interferences.
Can you just increase your volume, please? You're not audible enough.
Oh, yes. I'm saying that the context was that we were concerned about what was perceived or reported to be the National Treasury's interference with the PIC, and the GPF saying that PIC is not exclusively mandated to manage the fund and it can actually mandate others, and some of the unions saying that they are even thinking of withdrawing their funds from PIC's mandate of management and all of those things. I think that was the context of what was being reported about in the media. I think that is when we stepped in to say that there should be stability in terms of the relationship between GEPF and PIC, and we must be given an assurance that the monies of workers are going to be properly managed in a way that is not going to endanger the pensions of workers. And then say to workers that they must all speak for themselves as well. And then the workers came and unanimously said that part of the immediate interventions will be representation in the board of PIC, so that they could determine how their resources are going to be expended. They're not expended in useless government functions. I think that is the context that we should be dealing with the whole issue of PIC and GEPF. And perhaps to build on what the Honorable Hanekom is saying, it's what other mechanisms are available to insulate the yourselves or the monies that you have put in, or the bonds that you put in Eskom and all these state-owned companies that are in serious danger now. Like, you are overexposed to Eskom, 118 billion rands, if my numbers are correct here. I saw a news report today that, like, the problems of Eskom are deepening. The last time there was crisis in Eskom, we had to approve special appropriations and gave about 29 billion rands and had to write off a debt of more than 60 billion rands. What else do you think should be done to save the situation in Eskom? Because there seemed to be no improvement, even when there was that special intervention which we made when Ntlantlanene was Minister of Finance. That is a specific question that we wanted to ask in terms of what happened. I don't understand these numbers on the allocation of external of money to external managers, because when we asked this question in the last meeting, there was a mention of 90 billion, but I don't see 90 billion in the papers that you have submitted here. And then you mentioned some percentages that black asset managers are managing more than the others and everything else. But the numbers that are there is 70 billion to the mainstream, Sanlams and Coronations, and then to the other black asset managers. So it looks like there's a huge difference or distance between what you said in that meeting and what is now on paper here. And then the last issue, it's a legitimate issue that is raised by workers to say that what mechanisms are you engaged in to ensure that the owners of the money, the workers, immediately benefit out of the investments that the PIC makes on behalf of GEPF? There was a specific question raised on investments in housing scheme or finance, housing finance scheme that should immediately benefit workers. A very scary statistic was given that less than 30% of public servants own their own houses, whilst there is approximately 2 trillion that could be redirected otherwise for a far much more accessible housing finance scheme and to empower workers. I think that is one of the most concrete issues that we should respond to, of what are you doing to not just grow the monies of people who are going to get it when it's too late or when they're dead or when they're too old. They've got immediate challenges now. What concretely are you doing to make sure that they siphon off some benefits in the immediate in a manner in which that will be durable? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Shibambo. I think Honorable Shibambo was summarizing in a way and connecting the previous discussion. And some of the issues have been raised by the Deputy Minister when he was answering in the morning. And correctly so, the issue of the benefit. How are the workers benefiting from this investment, because they are the owners of the money. It was raised, and we were also told about Home SA or something. SA Home. Yeah. It was a serious matter, because we see as a committee that the owners of the money, who are the workers, they need to benefit from this investment. But then I will now request the PIC to give responses, and then GEPF thereafter, and hand over to the legal chair.
I'm very happy here, thank you.
Chairperson, my colleagues will help me with some of the questions here. But on SAA, if I can start with that, we made analysis in line with how we approach investments, and they couldn't meet minimum criteria that we've set for ourselves. We were worried about governance issues. We were worried about management instability, a lot of acting positions there.
I'm sorry, sir, can you...
Okay, thank you.
Raise your voice.
Yes, thank you, Chair. We were worried about governance issues, management. We were worried about the poor balance sheet. And all of those together, you know, were good reasons why we couldn't make the investment. It was not making the investment great. And we've seen positive changes. The board has been strengthened now. The CEO has been appointed. Now the turnaround plan has to be implemented. And unfortunately, it's going to take a few data points to convince us that the turnaround strategy is working. So we'll wait and see. Once we have enough data to convince ourselves that it has turned around, the balance sheet is looking much better, and there is stability, then we'll consider looking at it at that point. Telkom shares. This is a sensitive matter. We are dealing with a listed company, and therefore we will approach it, you know, in the same way as we approach any other investment, taking into consideration client mandate requirements and the risk parameters that the client has given to us. So we will, if we participate, we will participate to a extent that will satisfy our portfolio needs. I'm not in a position to give you numbers, unfortunately, honorable members. Independent news media, South Africa. Equity has dropped, indeed, because of valuations. We failed it down. Loans, what you see there is mainly accrued interest. It's accrued interest.
Are they going to be able to pay back?
We are busy working on an exit strategy around it. Yes.
Yeah, I will allow it because the chairperson does allow it.
Yes.
You can continue.
And because I tell them to
do. Yeah. So I'll also allow it.
Another question, the issue of downgrade, I think it's a difficult one. We have been hard at work as a PIC to try and invest in the economy through the monies that the clients have given us, because we recognize the importance of economic growth to ensure that there is asset growth. Now, a possible downgrade is looming, and we need to do something about it. We are doing our bit, as I say, by investing in those sectors of the economy that we believe are going to catalyze economic growth. And we are finalizing our policy on how we approach state-owned entities. You know, now that we have a much clearer understanding of what's happening there, policies around you know, what are the minimum governance requirements for the PIC to be able to invest in the state-owned entities on behalf of its clients. And that we are going to finalize this coming board meeting, and then we'll engage with our client for sign-off, and then from there it will be active, more active involvement in the affairs of state-owned entities where we have an interest in on behalf of our clients. Fund managers, honorable member, if I can explain the numbers there, you will see that the 73 billion refers to equity from the GPF, allocation of equity from the GPF, but it's also property, which is about 5 billion, fixed income 15 billion, as well as alternative strategies, which is about 500 million, in total making up 94 billion of assets that we've placed with external managers. We also have an allocation from UIF of another 6.5 billion. So if you add that, you get to a number that is more than 100 billion that we have allocated to black asset managers.
Are you done?
I think on the benefits for members of the GPF, I think we've taken a conscious decision a while back that the members of the fund must also enjoy their pensions before they retire. And we've been creating benefits for them from a housing scheme. We purchased a significant interest in SA Home Loans and used it to advance almost 10 billion for housing finance for members of the GPF, civil servants. That product is there and it's working very well, making a big difference. We've had the committee last time that there's a need to increase that. You know, we have to speak to our clients to have, you know, more allocation or relaxation of the mandate, you know, because it's about, again, taking additional risk, and they need to give us that permission to be able to increase the exposure in that sector. We have invested in a company called EduLoan that advances loan for education, of which I think the main customers will be members of the GPF. Probably more than 75% will be members of the GPF. And most importantly, we are now involving members of the GPF in BE deals, black empowerment deals that we are doing. We'll especially, you know, when we look at some of the companies that are very sound, because we don't want to give them exposure to bad companies. We're trying to create a less volatile portfolio with high yield that they can also participate in as BEE partners. So those are some of the ideas that we are putting on the table to benefit the members of the GPF before they retire.
Okay, I think there is something that was left, one of the questions that you have not answered about the interference of Treasury with PIC. But also I want to check on the answer before we go to GEPF. On the issue of SA Home, EduLoan, the Black Empowerment deals. In the environment that you're talking about of workers, there's a belief that there's nothing about them without them. I hope there has been consultation. We have the two federations here, the biggest in the public sector, and I hope you know these things that they're talking about. And there was a voice in the previous meeting about the SA Home, as to whether was this a choice or was there an agreement, or is it something that is enforced, or are even workers or the beneficiaries, the owners of these monies, are they aware about such kind of benefits? So those were the questions. But then before I go to GEPF, I know, Chairperson, you might think I'm eating on your time. I'll hand over just now. Can you just, and also check before you answer, check
which we
from
welcome.
The members if there's something that has been left out. Who has asked questions? Honorable Shibaku.
I think maybe Chairperson, we might need a far much more comprehensive response on this edu loan and SA Home Finance. How many beneficiaries have got to be assisted? How many GEPF members have benefited from those, not speculative percentages, the concrete numbers that these are the people, and what is the difference between SA Home Loans and the loans that are issued by the private banks? And what is the difference between, because my understanding of edu loan is like it's just any other loan, like where people go over the counter and then they're subjected to long processes, how much are you owing and all of the, how much do you earn and all of those things. There's very little difference between what people would ask over the counter and edu loan. Maybe we must be given a comprehensive report on the immediate benefits, even on these the component of BEE deals that are benefiting directly GPF members. We should be given a report of this is how they got to benefit out of it in the immediate. And the what explains the 38 billion to Coronation External Management? I see there's money there. Coronation Industrial, 38 billion. What is that about in the numbers that you have given there? What is the context of such a huge amount of money to one asset manager?
I think on the question about the number, the breakdown on how many people who are the beneficiaries, how many have benefited from all these things that you have mentioned. Can you agree as a committee that we give them 7 days to give that breakdown because they will not be able to do it now here? Okay? That's the agreement from the committee. I got an indication. Can you just answer the one question and then give over to GEPF?
Yeah, I think the answer to Coronation is that if you go back to 2009, when we started the Black Asset Management Program, almost all the funds were in the hands of the traditional asset managers, that is Investec, Coronation, and so on. But as you will see, over time, we have reduced that amount, and the majority of almost 60% of the funds are now in the hands of Black asset managers. And that transition is continuing. So it's not a surprise that we still have 38. In fact, it was a lot more. We cut it by half, almost.
Okay.
I think, Chair, in addition to what my colleague has said, we also have to generate returns for our clients as well. So this is the portfolio mix that gave us outperformance of the benchmark that the clients have set for ourselves. We can't run away from the fact that Coronation has been a very good manager in the portfolio that they've managed. They've delivered good alpha.
Okay, thank you. Can you hand over to GEPF?
Thank you, Chair. Just to go back to some of the questions that were asked, the first one was the relationship, the engagement between the GEPF and the Minister, especially given the fact that ultimately, of course, if things go badly, the government, in the first instance, who is the employer and through the Ministry of Finance, would have to provide a guarantee. So the question was what's the engagement between the Minister and the GEPF. And the GP law makes specific, so provides for that. And the one area where it's quite significant is in the determination of the strategic asset allocation. As my colleague presented at the last meeting that we just finished at the beginning of the year, a new asset liability model, which will have us re-look at the strategic asset allocation. Now, before the board has now made a decision, but before the board can actually implement, it has to go to the minister to ensure that the strategic asset allocation broadly ensures that we can protect the assets of the GPF from having a situation where we have to go to the minister to ask for any cash. Yeah. Now, that's quite important because I think the to most people, there is a sense that there is a misalignment between the interests of the GPF and government, and there isn't, because ultimately, if the assets of the GPF are mismanaged, or the economy is mismanaged and the assets do not perform, the government actually is setting itself, opening itself to the possibility of the fund going back to the government or the taxpayer in the final analysis to ask for additional money. So it's actually in the interest of everybody, both the board, the management, the PIC, to ensure that we manage the assets of the GPF to ensure that the fund does not get underfunded, because if it does get underfunded, unfortunately, the taxpayer will have to actually come to the party. So when we wake up in the morning, that's what we focus on, to make sure that we never have to come back to the government to ask for any meeting of a deficit. So preventing a deficit is one of the key issues. But the deficit is not only created by the mismanagement of assets. Also, having unrealistic benefits can also create the same problem. So salary increases and things like that, promotions that are not realistic, can also affect the liability side and create a strain on that side. That speaks to the issue around the potential downgrade. I think we must pray very much that it doesn't happen, because I don't think it's going to benefit anybody, so nobody has anything to celebrate a downgrade, so not having a downgrade is what we should aim for. But the interesting thing about downgrade for a fund is that while it affects the asset, it will also affect the interest rate, the discount rate that we actually use to work out the liability, and the two actually go hand in hand. So a downgrade will actually reduce the discount rate, which actually will also impact the liability as well. So there's two sides of the same coin, which one needs to look at. But hopefully, we as South Africans must not want a downgrade in any form. Preservation. We do have preservation, which is one of the benefits that we're coming to this house. I think in early next year, we've already submitted the rule amendment, the law amendment that needs to be passed. And one of the things that we are actually asking for is the allowing the GPF to provide for a preservation fund. Voluntary, not to force anybody, and also an additional voluntary scheme so that those members who want to take advantage of the difference between their contribution, the employer's contribution, and the tax allowed by the Tax Law Amendment Act, the 27.5% and the 22.5% that they pay, to actually make additional voluntary contribution. So that is still coming, because for that we need a law change, and that has to come to the House before we can do anything. So that, I think, is provided for. Then there's the issue of 19. There was an issue around the bonds. I think Dr. Dan covered that very well. I mean, I know that him and his team are not sitting back, but it's also too important to state the number of things. Most of these investments were made before the current things became apparent. These were made many years ago, so they were not just made in recent times. So I'm not making an excuse, but it's important to appreciate that there's hardly, I think, the last year or so, we hardly made any investment in state-owned enterprises. So this is a historical thing, number one. Number two, yes, I agree with Honorable Menir that we are overexposed to government, but I think if you go back to the strategic asset allocation, which is the slide that shows you your domestic bonds, which is the one that you focused on, but actually the second one is also quite important, the domestic equities. So actually our biggest challenge is our overexposure to the South African economy in whatever form. So that's more the issue, that we are engaging within the GPF and, of course, with the ministry as well. Not for the reasons that people say, but because that is really the issue. At the technical level, we do have an exposure to the economy in general, which we're trying to address. Then there was a question. Unlisted. There was unlisted. I think Dr. Dan, you covered that, so I don't have to repeat that. Then unclaimed benefits. Yes, we do pay interest on unclaimed benefits. I think if you look at the last line there is that actually a big chunk of unclaimed is actually interest that's being paid on the benefits. Just to be clear, that the GPF derives no benefit from having unclaimed benefit. We don't charge a fee, we don't, nothing. This money sits there until members claim it. And when they claim it, they are due the interest that is due to them. So we have no interest in actually retaining an unclaimed benefit in the GPF, just to be clear about that. Then there was an issue about the complaints. Unfortunately, I don't have the immediate statistics about the complaints from provinces, so we'll have to come back to the House about that. In terms of, we do have it back in the office, but I haven't got them with me now, so I can't
is
share.
Is it possible that you can get it in 7 days?
We can get that.
Okay.
In terms of our engagement, and I think there were a number of questions that speaks to something that is very close to the board's and this board's heart, and of course the chair of the BAC is here, is how do we communicate with members? How do we communicate with pensioners? How do we communicate with stakeholders? How do we educate them to make sure that they make the right right decision? That's a very, very key aspect of what we as the GPF are actually focusing on, for a number of reasons. Number one, I hear the issues around the kind of benefits we need to provide to members in terms of loans and everything else. But you must remember the average lifespan of a GPF pensioner is very long. It's about 30 years. So when a GPF goes on pension, they're going to live for another 30 years. I gave the example of somebody who's been, it's not for the fact, it's not a thumb suck. It's real people who have been on pension for 40, 45 years and have enjoyed the benefit for 45 years. A lot of people trade off their immediate needs, not understanding that they actually have a much bigger problem when they actually retire and they're going to live long. Yes, there are the unfortunate people who will die sooner, but the experience of the GPF, not of any other fund, the lifespan of an average lifespan of a GPF pensioner is 29 years, 0.7, just under 30 years. So it means that actually you should be focusing on ensuring that members have a pension when they go on pension, because they're going to be around for a long time. So the focus must be to ensure that we safeguard the pension in the first instance, because that's the really key of what we are tasked to do, and that's what we focus on before we look at everything else. Yes, there is a program that we engage our pensioners before they go on pension to sensitize them to the value of making sure that they preserve their pension. We prefer they do it to the GPF, but of course, unless they get taken for a ride when they transfer somewhere else, we have no issue with them transferring as long as they do transfer. The problem is they don't normally transfer everything, and that's a big challenge. Yes, we do work very closely in terms of stakeholder engagement with the HR departments, very much, and some of the problems that we're experiencing arise from that challenge of them not being able to give the proper advice to members from the beginning. That, I think, is the answer to the questions.
Thank you very much, Chair. While I'm going back to my seat, can I request that Fedusa then proceed to comment, but not make presentation, just comment. Thank you.
As you know, at the outset we explained we've got to take forward this resolution, right? That's our main reason for being here. So what we've got now is the PIC bill, an act. Our colleague from Partnership Services will take us through that. Then we will hear from Mr. Mania the DA bill, the private member's bill. It's been gazetted for comment for 30 days, Comrade Tikileri. And then Kosatu and Fedusa respond, and then we take a decision on where we go. We've got 50 minutes to do all of that, regrettably, but we should try to do it. So over to our colleague. You'll introduce yourself, my friend. We don't know you. Sorry. Yes. Yeah, can you say it in writing, please? Because, I mean, the main reason we've come, as I explained at the outset, is this resolution. We can't take resolutions and leave them hanging in the air. We're not going to meet again this year. The GPF was meant, with due respect to them, to just deal briefly with their annual report, which we can look at in February. But this is it. We pass resolutions, colleagues, and then we don't implement them. This is the main reason we are here. It even says at the end we'll meet before the end of November, and we will, if necessary, revise our decisions. So I'm in your hands. So, you know, I have to leave at 1, but Dikileri, you can chair at 1 o'clock. Dikileri, can you stay? Yeah, because we have another meeting of the ANC as well at 1 o'clock, but honestly, I really think this is the reason we are here. Can we please focus on the matter at hand? Over to you, my friend, from PIC. I mean, from the services unit on the PIC Act. Can you pick up on the main themes as we asked, right? Not the whole Act. Colleagues, you have the Act before you?
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chair. Good morning to everyone in the room. My name is Nolu Thando Mbikashe. I'm from the Legislative Drafting Unit in the Parliamentary Legal Services. Chair, I was asked to take you through the process of a committee bill and also to take you through the resolution and see what sections of the Act can be amended, and also to mention briefly that there is a private members bill that that also deals with the amendment of the PIC Act. And some of the issues that are in the resolution of the committee are catered for in the private members' bills based on the government gazette that was published for comment. Chair, the first thing on the resolution is that there should be representation of the trade union in the GPF, in the PIC. Section 6 of the PIC Act deals with a board of directors, and that's where this amendment could fit in, because then it would be dealing with the constitution of the board on who should sit in the board and all those things. The other thing that could be housed under Section 6 is the issue of the chairperson and the deputy chairperson of the board, which is discussed in or mentioned in Clause 4. In paragraph 4 of the resolution. The second thing, Chair, that is in the resolution is that the PIC should consider investing in projects that promote inclusive economic growth. That, Chair, that amendment would fit in under Section 10 of the PIC Act, which deals with investments of deposit. So the Act could be amended to cater for that. The other thing that is in the resolution is that the PIC should seriously consider the trade union's proposals on appropriate housing loan scheme for public sector employees who do not qualify for a loan from commercial banks. That could be a new clause, Chair, because currently in the Act there's nothing that deals with how the funds could assist members of the GEPF, so that could be a new clause. And I think that is those are the four things that I identified as the amendments that could be placed in the PIC Act. And then I think just to mention for importance, I won't go through the presentation because of time constraints, is that if the committee decides to do a committee bill, the committee would need to ask permission from the Assembly to do a committee bill. And also to mention, Chair, because Frankie told me that the committee was intending to have a bill by the end of November. That would be impossible, Chair, because of the processes that will need to be followed, and also because of the amendments. The Legislative Drafting Unit would also need time to look into the amendments. But considering that there's a private member's bill that already is in the process of being drafted and being introduced, maybe the committee might consider including those things in the private members' bill. Because as I've said, most of the things that the committee has raised concerns are already catered for in the private members' bills, but that is in the prerogative of the committee whether to do a committee bill or a private members' bill. Thank you, Chair.
Committee members, you've given us the Constitutional Court decision on Mr. Ambrosini's case, right? Can you confirm that this committee has no right to turn down a bill? Anybody has the right to bring a private member's bill. They bring it to the respective committee. It goes through a process. Can you confirm that no chairperson can dismiss any private member's bill, wherever they come from, in whichever party? That I have no such authority. Is that correct?
That is correct, Chair. The Constitutional Court pronounced on that on the Ambrosini case. So private members have a right to bring legislation to Parliament, and Parliament has a duty to process that legislation if it deems it desirable to do so.
All right, just for clarity, there is a bill before us, whichever party it comes from, we have to consider it. Am I correct, right? Okay. Having said that, can we then hand over to, on the process matters and so on, if anybody wants to raise questions, fine. The DA has got a bill. Mr. Meany, do you want to take us through your bill quickly? Maybe she'll answer that question now then. What Peace Mabe wants to know is, once the bill comes to the committee, the private member's bill, what do we do then? Is that what you're asking? Yeah.
Chairperson, the rules provides that the bill must be published in the Government Gazette for comment, and then after that it must be tabled in the Speaker's office. And then the Speaker will read it, it will go into the House for the first reading, and then the Speaker will send it to the relevant committee, which in this case will be this committee. And then in terms of the rules, this committee would have to inquire into the bill, inquire into the subject matter of the bill. By they may invite interested parties to come and make comments on the bill, like the department and the PIC and the GPF in this case, or the trade unions. And then after that, the committee will have to consider a motion of desirability on the bill to see if the bill is desirable based on the discussions that were taken in the committee. And all in all, Chair, the committee has a duty to process the bill and pass the bill or reject the bill. Thank you, Chair.
Out, colleagues, if you can look at your emails, Alan sent out all of those things. He gave the Ambrosini judgment, court judgment. He gave the rules that you've just answered to. So if colleagues can look at that. That's the process for now. Okay, Mr. Mania.
Chair, as you know, that we have a draft private members bill, and on the basis of that, we've published a memorandum setting out the objectives of the bill, and then also the principal clauses in the bill. In terms of the rules, that memorandum must be published in the Government Gazette for a period of 30 days. The window opened on the 31st of October and will close at the end of this month on the 30th of November. During that time, we will obviously take submissions based on the memorandum, and then on the basis of those submissions, we will produce the final draft of the private members' bill. The memorandum sets out the objectives of the bill, which I won't take you through. We've traversed that matter before. But the bill specifically provides, first of all, for the chairperson of the PIC board to be appointed by the minister on the recommendation of the National Assembly following consideration of a shortlist of nominated candidates and with due regard to experience and qualification. So that would be the first clause. The remainder of the PIC board would comprise of 12 members, which would include representatives of the PIC's sole client, being the department, and then also the major depositors. We then also say that in respect of all directives issued by the minister, those directives should be tabled in Parliament and published on the PIC's website, I beg your pardon, to ensure greater transparency in respect of the operations of the PIC. We also say that the PIC should disclose all investments on an annual basis, and that it should do so on its website. We then say that the PIC should also include in its annual report a list of all requests to the minister for that year in respect of significant transactions, again to provide for greater transparency at the PIC. We then say that the minister will table all regulations in the National Assembly prior to publication of the final regulations, giving the National Assembly a chance to provide the minister with inputs on the draft regulations. So it's a clause very similar to the clause that we've already adopted in the Twin Peaks legislation. Again, that will provide, I think, greater transparency in respect of regulations. Then in respect of transitional arrangements, we say that there is an onus to deal with the composition of the board progressively rather than immediately on promulgation. But then we also say that in respect of the chairperson, we would want to ensure that the parliamentary process commences within 6 months of the bill's promulgation. Those are the rough clauses, Chair. The window is now open. We are receiving submissions. Based on those submissions, we need to obviously make a final determination of where we stand and then produce the final private members bill, which we'll do hopefully in the first week of December.
Members, just an in-house matter. Not in-house. We want to welcome Advocate Douglas Shaw, who's here. There he is. He's the gentleman taking up a case on behalf of a large number of people whose properties were repossessed and sold at values way below their market value. We have actually supported it in our financial sector transformation report, and we'll have 2 minutes where you might want to say something. Thank you. Over to members on the issue of the bills, but let's have Kosatu. You have a bill as well. You have got a copy of Kosatu's bill, draft bill. Can you take us through it, Matthew?
Okay, thanks very much, Chair. Sorry. I don't know if our thing can be called a bill, more a submission, but we take the compliment. We might have to clean up the English afterwards now that you're promoting us to drafting bills. Because you can't put all angry swear words in bills. I think, Chair, just a couple of points. And also, I'm joined by my colleague, Yanni Ustazen from FODUSA, from the PSC, and also Comrade Tengo Tengera from Nahau. So literally between the three of us, you would have 90% of the Public Service Bargaining Council represented. Look, Chair, just a few points. I think we'd really welcome the spirit of the committee's discussions across all three party lines. We're very much hopeful and inspired by it. We would really welcome a bill through the committee which will strengthen oversight, checks and balances in the PIC. I think we'd all agree that given it's almost 2 trillion rand, we can't afford for it to fail, as we've seen SABC, SAA, etc. We do welcome the Deputy Minister's earlier comments about him and the Minister being willing to engage. We are available anytime, and we'll also raise that with our public service affiliates. I think she would also welcome the Honourable Shivambu and other members' proposals and the Ministry's agreement that you already have immediate representation of the unions from the PSCBC on the board. I think our proposals around the existing PIC Act and looking at the private members' bills was one around union representation being compulsory. We think there's an easy formula that you have the Public Service Central Bargaining Council. You simply have it being proportional according to the PSCBC. So if COSATU today is two-thirds, fine, two-thirds of the reps to be from COSATU. If tomorrow solidarity is 90%, we'd have to forfeit to them. We think that's a fairly neutral, non-partisan way to do it. I think, Chair, also we're proposing that you follow the industry norm where the depositors have 50% representation, in this case being the GPF, the UAF, etc. We would welcome a role for Parliament in selecting other board reps, the non-union reps, for example. I think, Chair, having gone through the PIC Act, it's quite an amazing how thin the Act is. Maybe it was done in the era of a honeymoon era. Though it's only, I think, 13 years old. But it gives the minister carte blanche for directives. It just says the minister could issue directives to the PIC if it's in the public interest. So if the minister decides it's in the public interest to invest in Saxon World, PIC is really having its hands tied, which is, for us, given what's at stake, it's a... Well, in fact, East Germany was much more strict, but anyway. But yeah, let's leave the GDR, it's collapsed. So I think, for us as one space, Chair, I think as you said, Chair, in the previous meeting, let's look at the checks and balances around the minister's powers and so on. And for us, Chair, look, maybe we've also had internal discussions around the role of the chairperson, whether it's a minister or a non-minister. I think for us, really what's important is around the checks and balances over the chairperson. So we don't want to find a situation where we have an executive chair de facto like at SAA, where really you have the chairperson of the board in day-to-day operational matters, intimidating the CEO and the board, etc. So I think for us, the key issue is the checks and balances around the chair. We'd also want to see a situation where for large investments above norm, for any changes to the mandate or directives, there should be prior approval from the GPF itself. So the PIC shouldn't just report to the PIC to the GPF after the effect. We would welcome similar reports to Parliament, even if it's on an annual basis. I think in terms of the mandate, Chair, we'd want to see a much clearer developmental job creation mandate, and of course to include the issue that's been raised and a joint support around housing for public servants. We're glad that members have discussed it and it's been supported, because there's something the PSCBC units have been raising with Treasury and being blocked by Treasury over the years. So we're hopeful that we'll see progress there, Chair. I think lastly, Chair, just the last few issues. I know Fudusa will not agree with us, but as COSATU, we're quite keen that it be legislated that the PIC be the investment arm for the GPF, for the UAF, for COIDA. And I think, Chair, taking inspiration from the Paulo, if you remember, comments last time, they want to see the political office bearers pension funds also being invested here. But also, Chair, the parastatals as well. Really, we need to see consolidation of public investment through the PIC. I think maybe it also helps, Chair, if politicians see the pensions are there, they'll be much more circumspect, which is a useful thing, and we'll all be in the same boat together. The lastly, Chair, I think we'd really support a bill coming through the Select Standing Committee. We wouldn't want it to be given to the exec, because then it might take 5 years. Not we are undermining the exec, but we know these things take forever and ever. So, Chair, I think, yeah, lastly, we're quite happy with the progress, and maybe my colleagues, Tengo from Nahau and Yanni from Fedusa, might want to add. Thanks very much, Chair.
Do you want to say anything? You're fine. Our friend from Fedusa? George rang me yesterday, said he can't come, and we said, send somebody. The aim is for us to act now, but you can speak for a few minutes. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. As Honourable Members know, I can actually say ditto what my comrade of COSATU is saying. We are in the same boat. We're united as Labour, as unions. Yes, although there might be one or two different aspects or different views, especially on the PICB, the only entity as the investment corporation, which we are of the view that you can't put your basket, all your eggs in one basket. And we would rather support, it will be the first choice, but we would rather support that there be more than one investment and corporation in this matter. And then just to comment on the PIC's response to say that the SA Home Loans is there. I'm one of the chief negotiators within the PCBC, and we know there's a government employee housing scheme in place. But there's no loan scheme in place which talk to the specific needs that we anticipate from the PIC in order to assist those members that could not get loans from the commercial banks. So I really doubt that there is a home loans. You might have invested in this home loans, yes, but definitely that loan scheme that we envisage to assist our members does not exist at this stage. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members.
Thank you very much. Can we hand over to members' questions, comments on the process and on the content of the bills? Mr. Shivambu Floyd? Derek?
No, thanks, Chair. I think that we had agreed in principle that we should make some amendments to the existing legislation that establishes the PIC and defines its role. So whichever way it comes, Let's engage in that process, even if it's a committee bill or private members bill. And if it's a private members bill, I think the obvious political question will be, no one must be triumphalist about it, Mr. Meniere. It must be an agreed committee process, because I think that we agree in terms of the key issues. I think the most important issue is to say that the composition of the board must be democratized and must be an open and transparent process. That is the most important aspect of it. Because Section 6.2 of the PIC Act now says that the minister must take due regard of nominations that come from depositors. So it's loose, like, because he composes, the board is composed, but there's no depositors represented directly. So the Act must be clear that this is how it should be. And perhaps maybe learning from the other experiences of state-owned companies, we should perhaps legislate a process of democratically compositing the board, like a parliamentary process, which is open and accountable, because I think the experiences of all state-owned companies, Transnet, Eskom, Dinel, is that the whole framework of leaving the composition of the board to one individual has got huge consequences, that a person can get a list from Sachs and Weld and appoint all of those people to ESCOM, and then they collapse the whole institution. Because that's what law says now. I think we have to prevent that. So let's start with the PIC to say that let's insulate it before the whole thing of a minister compositing the board takes effect. It is potentially dangerous in the manner in which it is now, and has been proven with the other boards. I think we should legislate that the PIC is the exclusive manager of the GEP fund. I think that is one of the most important things, so that Mr. Stoller doesn't say in an interview that he can mandate other managers directly, doesn't need the PIC. It may not be him now, it may be someone else who maybe found themselves there, and then they take a trillion rand of that money and give to Coronation. They can take that decision, and the board of trustees, and say, no, we think Coronation is more profitable. It brings more returns. Let us just mandate Coronation to manage this. Okay. Or someone can take a decision that the dynamics in South Africa are not proper. The economy is not stable. We are even facing downgrading. Let us go and invest the money in Europe. I don't think that there must be that leeway that is given. So let us legislate that the PIC, which is democratically constituted, should be the exclusive manager of the GEP fund. We can add UIF and the other clients that are there. I'm not sure about the parastatal pension funds. It's one of the things that you must think thoroughly about to check if you must include the state-owned companies. But it will be too big an institution. I think it will go to possibly 2.5, 2.6 trillion. If you include ESCOM and Transnet and Dinel and all of those things, it will be unnecessarily huge.
Thank you. Welcome to comment on the... Just to clarify to members in case of misunderstanding, we're taking no decisions here, nor are we formally processing the bill. What we are seeking to do is to look at the broader issues, signal where we are at the moment, tentatively short of concrete mandates on each of the 7 or 8 issues that have arisen, and then look into the form in which we proceed. Do we have a private member's bill, or do we have a committee bill and incorporate the private member's issues, and so on and so on. So that's what we're doing. We're taking no decisions here. Okay, having said that, can we move on? Who's going to say what? We've got very limited time, colleagues. Yes, Mr. Hanick?
Okay, I don't think we need to spend an awful lot of time on it, but at the moment we have a private members bill, and there are certain procedures that are prescribed, as David shared with us, and that the time only expires at the end of November for public comment on the gazetted private members bill. So, I mean, they can't really move forward the private member in this case who gazetted the bill has to obtain that public comment, and that takes us to the end of November. So effectively, we can't really, if we, you know, that process in motion, if we want to ride on that process, which is already in motion, we can't do much more before the November the 30th deadline anyway. Secondly, I want to agree with Floyd that it shouldn't be about, you know, in this case, a private member initiated it. It's not for us, it shouldn't be a major issue. It should be about the content. And at the end of the day, in any event, whoever initiates it, a private member's bill, it becomes the ownership of the committee in any event, because the committee then considers the bill, makes the necessary changes to the bill. Thirdly, I want to say, and this is quite positive, that there's a degree of overlap between what is being proposed. By the way, we don't actually have the bill in front of us. All we have is the objectives of the bill, what do you call it, that were gazetted, but the actual amendment bill we don't have. and maybe Mr. Mania can make that available to us. But there's a lot of overlap between what COSATU is putting forward as elements to be contained in this amendment and what is being proposed by the private member. So I think if we can consolidate these views, but I don't think it's going to happen before the end of November in any event, so maybe we should, because we have so much to do, maybe we should just, you know, sort of postpone it and deal with it early next year.
Oh, sorry, one last thing.
I mean, I'm just curious whether, because the PIC are here, and whether they would be, as part of this gazetting period and getting public comment on the gazetted private members' bill, whether they would be making submissions on this gazetted bill.
Yeah, I'm going to ask them for their tentative views, so I think it's good. Let's start with that, right? Declare, do you want to say something? You sure? Pinky? No. Peace? No. All right, so I'm guided by what's before the committee, okay? I'm a chairperson, what do I do? Right, so here we are. Now, the first thing is, can the GEPF, as Comrade Derek says, I know you need board meetings and so on. I'm not saying you must come with final positions. Nor is Derek or anybody or me mandated to take final positions, right? So we're all, you know, as I clarified, we're all like, you know, we can't waste this time. We have to move forward. So, tentatively, you're not bound by anything. What's your tentative responses? Let's start with the GEPF, if you want to offer them. Your tentative responses, do you think, like, if something's outlandish, you can say, for now, we don't think it's reasonable. You can't use the word outlandish, right? Though I don't mind, but you might object. Okay.
We don't think this... I mean, I think that there are a number of things that are positive. The issue of transparency, reporting on the investments, having a sense of what are the transactions that might have come up as a consequence of the ministerial interaction with the PIC. So I think especially the principles that underlie the suggestions is something that we don't find to be outlandish at all. There is a question, and of course the composition of the board as well, which is already reflected in the act, but not sufficiently, not sufficiently explicit, I think, to give effect to the spirit of what was intended. So in terms of those are our tentative comments, but we will make a proper submission at the appropriate time.
Okay, who's next? PIC, did you want to say anything, Mr. Nkonazi? Is he here? Yeah. Oh, there he is.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We've perused the proposed private members amendment bill separately. Members of the PIC board, as the CEO mentioned earlier, we will be meeting as a board, and it is tabled for the board discussion this coming Friday. We'll make a proper comment, but needless to say that they say there's a stakeholder and a stake. We are a stake here. We really cannot influence this too much.
All right. A few quick things. Do you want to sit on, Jan? Yeah.
Well, I hope my comments are not dangerous, but... I would go to an extent of saying that the capital of the PIC must be open to the depositors as well as wider public, and not only held by the GPF, by government. And the reason here is that we always grapple in terms of dividends. You know, how do we deal with dividends? You know, do you pay dividends to government when the fund is not doing well, or do you reinvest in a way back into the fund. You know, if you declare that dividend, then it goes to the members, depositors as well. So you are reinvesting in a way. So it really kills this argument around why dividend to government when you can reinvest the money, you know, if we can open the capital in that way.
Since we have limited time, one is obviously the majority will decide, but I also need to just raise something I raised before, which is at the end of the day, it's the national fiscus that will have to come to the rescue if something goes wrong, because it's a defined pension benefit fund, right? Now, people draw analogies between state-owned entities like Eskom and Transnet, that the chair of the board is not the deputy minister of public enterprises or minister. Agreed. And so they draw a similar thing, because then the loan guarantees are coming from the fiscus. Yes, there are perils, but I think one should be cautious. That's all I'm pleading. Let's think this through. Is there no way we can find a compromise between the current situation, which is not even legislated, if I'm correct, Norotando, that the deputy minister of the finance portfolio ministry has to be the board chair? That's not in the law, right? So I think now we must take a decision on that. Now, between that and Parliament just deciding on who the board chair should be, is there some compromise we can have, like very clear criteria and so on? And if we have it as a package, you look at it as a package, more transparency, more effective oversight, we must be real also. When we say all these things, can we deliver? Can we meet more often than we currently are and so on? Let's take unclaimed benefits, colleagues. We passed two major resolutions on unclaimed benefits. We haven't implemented it. So we also are guilty of taking decisions and not implementing it. So all I'm saying, I'm just pleading. As a chair, I'm not taking any decisions. I have no mandate from my party anyway. All I'm simply saying is that's the one issue I think one should tread very carefully on. Secondly, I don't know enough, but there are market sensitivities also. So when you talk of transparency, when you're talking of investments and so on, yes, there are market sensitivities applied to SOEs and so on. Does the same degree of market sensitivity apply here, or is it tougher here where you have to make decisions? That's another thing you want to think about, comrades. I won't say we take any decisions, but somebody, Zakele, somebody's noting these things, and Nolotando, you'll do some work, and so will Zakele and Antonia. Thirdly, we can only make a political call here, which we said before, that whatever the differences between the trade unions, it would be nice if you came with a united position. You also need, whatever your differences, in my view, anyway, I don't speak for the majority necessarily, but nothing stops me from speaking. The members will just say what they want to say without mandates, but so what's wrong with me saying it? Politically, I really think you need to unite, whatever your differences are. And this is a sort of issue where all of you are showing a common interest. What divides you? And this is the next issue I want to raise. Personally, I don't have a view. And anyway, who cares what view it is, right? Because the majority will decide. But I think this thing about making the PIC the soul, I like it personally. Ideologically and politically, it suits me personally. But what are the implications of that, putting it in the law? What if the PIC at some stage in the post-Daniel Nkwanazi stage goes wonky? What if, for example, the EFF is in power? God forbid. Not that I believe in God, but in any case, you trust Matthew, these guys. Worse if it's Mr. Media here, right? So these are things you need to think about. It's no more the era until Jesus comes. But that's not the reason. Objectively, do you really want to do some of these things, or do you want to find some compromises? Members, think about it. Then I want to make something categorically clear. I was very soft in what I said, Matthew, but that is my personal position. All I said was, it's very easy for us to sit here and demand that the PIC and GEPF go and invest here, there, and everywhere. How come our own pensions are not at issue? We'll have more credibility if our own pensions were put into that collective fund in some form or another, right? I spoke about credibility. I have no mandate from the ANC. So please, the media is here. I don't want a headline saying a chairperson of committee calls for members' pensions to be put into the GEPF, because I have no mandate, right? And my head will get chopped off, maybe, not least by members here. So I'm simply saying I'm making a general point as a chair might, which is to say, presumably, if anybody wants to quote me at all, and hopefully this is not really something major, but if anybody wants to, just get it right. Presumably, members of parliament will have more credibility in making, in steering the PIC to invest in certain developmental projects if we ourselves had our pension in a similar fund. That's all I'm saying. It's about credibility. Now, I was told by a certain member of the opposition, the difference between the two is that the one is a defined benefit pension fund, that is the people who are government employees, and the members of parliament, public representatives, have no such guarantee or protection. Then the next question arises, nevertheless, is it not morally and politically necessary to consider that? That is all. I'm asking questions. I'm making no point.
Yeah,
so can we clarify, Matthew? Otherwise, you're going to get me into trouble, right? Okay. Having said that, I want to make one final plea. And this is addressed to all the members. Yes, we can have a private member's will because it's before us, and Nolotando has explained. It's faster to process it like that. I'm not convinced because December, only Baba Hanikum will be here. The rest of us will be campaigning for a certain election. So whether he brings the bill, Mr. Mania, in the first week of December or the last week of January is neither here nor there for the processing of Parliament, right? And I would like to say that Mr. Mania considers, as I've raised with him before and I've raised in this committee, that because there is no substantial difference, broadly speaking, on the issues, there are three or four things that we can settle to compromises, that we convert that private member's bill into a committee bill. Nolotando, you can speak with Mr. Mania and see whether it's possible. I will try if the committee mandate is... So we have it as a committee bill, right? Because also it's more credible. We will acknowledge Mr. Mania in the report, having brought all of that, we'll acknowledge. We will write to little John, I mean Mr. Steyn is, I'm sorry, we'll write a letter to him and say, you know, he did deliver, and so for his performance assessment, I don't know, EFF, what performance assessments you have, there's a tick box thing here. So we will acknowledge that he issued 10,000 media statements to which the chair didn't respond on this matter, and it is Mr. Mania, we'll produce a copy of this bill, so they can tick it off and so on, and then he can get his performance bonus, right, which is status and acknowledgement. Let me finish before time. You brought it upon yourself. All right, on a more serious note, Mr. Lees, you have your hand up. Now you know who it was that gave me that answer. Okay, so here it is. We hear where we are. The only outstanding issue of processing, Mr. Demania and Mr. Lees, we ask you to consider converting it into a committee bill. But in our report, we have to be fair. Mr. Mania brought it up. So he just jumped the gun. We were going to do similar things anyway. And the other final question, in the interest of transparency, it's addressed to Matthew. Matthew, can you tell us how many private meetings you've had with a certain person from a certain party who brought a certain private member's bill on a certain matter? Did you have a mandate from COSATU to meet with such said individual? Yeah. What does this mean? Because you are calling for the alliance to be renegotiated. Does it imply that you're looking for a new alliance? If so, why are you not looking to your left, so to speak, only geographically speaking, for a certain party whose representative wears red? Why are you turning to the right, which is very appropriately located in that context of that question? Can you kindly answer this question, as Dikeledi would say, within 7 days in writing? Sorry. But let's take this opportunity of thanking Mr. Mania for his bill. It's for once a very sober set of issues. It's surprising. I have no doubt he never himself drafted this or thought of this. It must have been some other moderating influence. But having said that, Mr. Mania, I must thank you for bringing this before us. And for now, can members remain for a few minutes to look at the program quickly, because we have some very practical decisions to make. And then can we thank the GEPF and the PIC for their concerted cooperation and look forward to the end. Thank you. Members, can you look at the issues that are outstanding?